Mrs. McMahon, can you just tell us about your childhood when you were growing up and like your friends and schools?
I was born at Annapolis Rock in Howard County in 1908. I was about 5 years old when we moved to a little town of Poplar Springs. That's 1 mile from Lisbon. Our address was Mount Airy because four counties of Maryland came together there. So I lived in Howard, but the address was Carroll. I went to elementary school in Poplar Springs through the sixth grade. Then I went to the Lisbon High School. I graduated in 1926 from the Lisbon High School. My father had a farm. We all had chores to do. I lived on that farm until 1926 when I went to college.
Or maybe about what it was like growing up on the farm or in school, some of the courses you had.
I enjoyed school very, very much. I always got very high grades in school except in history, which I did not like. I always got A's in geometry and calculus and all those things. We had real good teachers. It was very good living on the farm. As I say, we had chores to do, and we had to do them before we went to school and at home. My family consisted of eight altogether. There were just five of us living within the last 10 years. Now, only four. We had everything that you would naturally think on the farm, and the boys took care of cows and so on, and we girls took care of the housework and the chickens. My father raised a lot of chickens, and I always had to water them.
That was very interesting growing up. Mr. McMahon, would you like to tell us about your childhood and some of the things you had to do then?
Well, I was born November the 12th, 1911. And I was born in North Carolina, just outside of Asheville, North Carolina, and a place at that time was called English, but it's been changed to Mars Hill, North Carolina. My parents, we didn't live there too long because we moved to Virginia. My father was kind of a self-made mining engineer. And we lived in Virginia, and I went to elementary school and in Virginia and high school in Ridgeway, Virginia. That was our hometown. And from high school, I went to business school, business college in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Now, this was in 1929, and things were pretty tight in 1929 and a few years after that. So I felt that I was ready to go out into the world. I had a complete commercial and business training and banking along with it, and I thought I was ready to go out, but you know, jobs were just very, very scarce back then. So, of course, I didn't get a job right away, but anyway, I had two uncles that lived in Baltimore, Maryland, and one of them came by one day and he said, "How about going to Maryland with me?" I said, "Well, I might as well." So I came on up to Baltimore, and I lived with my uncle for short time with one of them, and then of course I moved to the other uncle. But in the meantime, I met my wife, and of course that was the beginning of our getting together, and eventually our marriage.
Well, if you'd like to just...
In 1926, I graduated from high school, and then I went to Western Maryland College, and I started there in September 26, and I graduated from there in June 1930. And that was before I met him, you see. And I was very fortunate because I taught biology, a science, and therefore biology teachers were a little more in demand. And I got a call from Mr. C. Milton Wright, the superintendent of schools here in Bel Air, and he asked me whether I would come over for an interview, which I did, and the very next day he phoned me, said he was sending a contract and that I had the job for Bel Air High School, of which I taught the entire time of 34 years. Not in the same building, because we got a new school in between. And that's when we met.
She was teaching in Bel Air, of course, when I met her, really, through a first cousin of mine. And of course, that was my first visit to Bel Air. One Sunday morning, I had called her and said maybe I should come up today, and I met her on a Sunday. But when I got off of the McMahon bus, I rode the McMahon bus, which is my name, to Bel Air, and when I got off the bus, I looked around in front of the courthouse, and across the street was Vaughn Hotel. So there, my name is James Vaughn McMahon, and I thought, well, I'm already established here. This is where I think I should be. So that was the beginning, my first trip to Bel Air to see her. Where she lived on Main Street, right opposite the movie. That was in 1931. Mm-hmm. That's been a long time ago, hasn't it?
We were married in 1932 on Christmas Day of that year, December 25th. I had 1 week off. We established living in an apartment in Baltimore, and I commuted to Bel Air. So we didn't miss any time from work at all. That makes us, of course, married 54 years yes. at this point.
Well, in December, I guess it would be.
Yes.
But when we moved to Bel Air, of course, I still worked in Baltimore, and eventually we decided that the commuting back and forth to Baltimore, that I should get established in Bel Air, because she was well established as a teacher. So I applied for a job as a police officer in the town of Bel Air. And this was April the 1st, 1937, that I went to work. Mr. John N. Kunkel was the mayor at that time. And I went to work for the town as an officer. There were only two of us at that time. So we had the chief, and I guess I was the assistant chief. I was his assistant anyway. So, of course, that was the beginning of my working with the town of Bel Air back in 1937. Now, Bel Air was a very small town back then. I would guess that the population of Bel Air maybe 15 to 2,000 at that time, and of course there was only two of us as police officers, and we worked very closely with the sheriff's department at that time. Mr. Granville Boyle was sheriff, and of course we had the old sheriff's house and the jail opposite the courthouse, and at that time the iron fences were still around the courthouse, and of course the old drinking fountain was still in front of the courthouse, which was finally moved to the to in front up off of the roadway up in front of the courthouse. And a storm blew a tree on it and bursted it all over. And of course, you know, the recent it's drinking fountain, or the fountain, you know, has been restored. It's a new one, and it's been installed back where it was originally, long many years ago. But I had taken pictures of the old fountain back then, and of course they came to me for pictures as to how it looked at that time.
It was interesting to note how teaching was different back in 1930. I was the only biology teacher in Bel Air from 1930 to 1957, which meant when I came here, I had as many as 50 to 55 people in a class. And of course, laboratories were not so easy with that number. In 1938, we had a son, so I went out of school for 3 years, but still went back to the old school on Gordon Street. And I went back for a half a year in about 41. I went back permanently in 42. It's very different, as I say, because today they feel that they should have about 25 in a class. the salaries were also different at that time, but we expect changes to occur over 30 to 40 years.
Well, I know that when I started working for the town, I made $17.50 a week. It was just work. There was no plans for vacation. There was no sick leave. Of course, if you got sick, you couldn't work. But it was just work all the time. And the chief at that time was making $20 a week. So finally, we got nerve enough to ask the commissioners, "Well, how about a little raise?" So I got $20 a week, and the chief got $22.50, I think, a week. So salaries were very, very small in comparison to now. I got my highest salary while I worked for the town, which was 36¾ years, and I had 26 of those years I was chief of police, and my highest salary was only $12,200, whereas I retired, of course, in 1973, and within this short time since I retired, and now the salary for the chief of police, I think, is I would estimate around $30,000. So there's quite a difference, isn't it, in the
Well, when I started, I got $100 a month for 10 months. We had 2 months off in the summer, but we did not get paid. We had to budget our money during the year to live during the summer. And the most that I made in teaching 34 years was $9,000. I retired in 1968, and that was my salary at that time. In comparison, the beginning teachers are making something like $20,000 to $23,000 now.
Well,
but I loved it. I would never give up a day of school. I enjoyed every day I went to school and every day of teaching, and every one of my children. And I can't say that I ever had any real discipline problems. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. Of course, the people of Bel Air were very good to us too. Parents were very cooperative with school teachers. They were interested in what their children did, and they sent their children to school to work. The children knew that, the teachers knew that, and the parents did, and therefore there were no problems.
Well, I as the chief of police, enjoyed a very, very good relation with the children. And I used to go to the street corners in the morning and in the afternoons and help them across the street, tie their shoes, sing them a little song, "Oh, what a beautiful morning," and I just had a very, very good relation with the children, with the smaller children. They were the elementary school children, and also with the high school children. We get invited every so often, my wife does as a teacher, to a class reunion, and it's really great to meet and see these youngsters that we knew many years ago in school, and how progressive they are, and how they have progressed in the business world, and also with marriage and family. It's really interesting to talk to some of them, you know, about how many children you have and things like that.
Yeah, the thing that I think is so good is that when we go to these reunions, every one of them seems so happy to see us. They put their arms around us and they really are happy to see us. I can think of many, many places in town whose manager is one of the children that I taught, Donald Preston, Dr. Eugene Street, George Harrison, used to be the Forest Hill president, he died, Jim Magnus, but all of these boys around town now who are the business managers and conduct the business, I taught. And that's quite a joy to look back and see what they're doing. I taught 6,244 children. I kept a count of them during the 34 years, even though I was out three.
We, of course, have time marches on, you know, and of course we reach the retirement age, and we are not as well as we at this time as we would like to be, but we don't travel much anymore. We a few years ago we had a trip to Europe and Germany and Switzerland, went to the Alps, and we had a Caribbean cruise. We've been to Bermuda, and then we had we traveled out west one time, and we got as far as Colorado, but I don't know, we just kind of ran out of steam at that point and turned around and came back. But we haven't traveled as much as we'd really like to, but I think that we've gotten in some real nice trips, and it's very nice to sit back some time and look at all the pictures and the places that you've been, you know, because I'm kind of a camera bug. I take a lot of pictures, and I have taken pictures of the town of Bel Air through the years, particularly if they were tearing a building down. I wanted a picture before it was destroyed, and I have a photo book so large with all kind of pictures showing the town as it was torn down, actually. Buildings like the Country Club Inn, the Yew Tree Inn, Kenmore Inn, Mrs. Fulford's house, that's the Boyden Fulford people, you know, where the Loyola Bank is located now, and buildings across the street where the Equitable Trust building is located, and there are just a lot of pictures. I have a picture of going back to school, the black school, elementary school. I have a picture of that. It's a small building. It was placed on Hay Street, but it was moved from the present site of the post office on North Main Street, and they moved that building down there for the black elementary school, and I'm not so sure if that wasn't maybe part of the high school too. The man that informed me of that was Stephen Moore. He, of course, they were old time residents, black people who lived on Hayes Street. Hannah Moore was his mother, and of course he was a school principal, I think, wasn't he, honey?
He was Steve a principal, and also he's on the Board of Education now. Yeah. We might go back to 1938 when our son was born, and I was out 3 years, but he was working for the police from 3 to 12, and longer if need be. So he took care of the baby in the afternoon, and I went to school in the morning. That's how I did a half a day. But we might say that he was in school from 1930 to 1956, and remembering that I said I was the only biology teacher, and the state of Maryland required that every child take biology. So therefore, I taught my own son, and I taught Dr. Willis's daughter and Mr. Carroll's son and all the officials, and I enjoyed thoroughly doing that, as I had those people in academic classes. And our son now is the owner of the radio station in Aberdeen, WAMD, and he has two children. One of them just graduated from college in June from Towson University, and the daughter, the youngest one, is a senior this year and will graduate in May 1987. So we've had a very, very good family.
Mr. McMahon, when you became a police officer, did you just have to have an application, or did you have to go to some special training like they have academies nowadays?
Well, Raymond Faulker was the chief of police. Raymond Faulker was a single man at that time. And since I was visiting my wife, I was single, and Raymond Faulker and I became friends because he was going with his wife, Nellie Hood, and we walked around town together, you know.
We were friends. We'd lived together in the same town at home.
Yeah. So, the opportunity presented itself that there was an opening for a police officer, an assistant to the chief. So he says, why don't you talk to Mr. Kunkel about it? Mr. Kunkel was the mayor at that time. And I did, and Mr. Kunkel agreed to give me the job as a police officer. So that was the beginning, and it happened to be April the 1st, 1937, April Fool's Day. So
he wanted to know what training you had after that.
So now I had no police training prior to that at all. Of course, taking a job, I was green at it, I guess, but it didn't take long for me to encounter maybe someone who was intoxicated. And of course, with the present chief, Raymond, and of course, Grandma Boyle, who was the sheriff at that time, and he was elected in 1934, I believe it was, the sheriff of Harford County, the sheriff could not succeed himself back then. He could only serve 4 years. And of course, we did not have a police department. We had a town office at that time was just a one room on Office Street that the commissioners would meet twice a month. And we, of course, the chief and I attended the meetings, of course, to keep up with and inform really the commissioners as to what was going on around town. And it was just an overall job for the police to see that there were the streets were didn't have too many chug holes in them, you know, and that the garbage was picked up, you know, regularly, but we didn't
train.
But starting from that, from the sheriff's department, they had no real official training at all. But right from the beginning, I knew and learned to know the sheriff, the Maryland State Police commander, and the FBI. And of course, I relied on them very strongly. I attended all kind of any class, any kind of instructions that they might have open, you know, to attend. And I think the first class that I attended was in 1939, and I have a picture of that group in the old post office building downtown, an FBI fingerprint class. And I learned a great deal about fingerprinting and classifying fingerprints. Now, when I worked with the sheriff's department, somehow or other they asked me if I would take the photographs. And of course, I photographed all the prisoners that came in and out and fingerprinted. So that started our files of photos and fingerprints, really, of the sheriff's office. And I did that for quite a number of years after finally the chief of police was elected sheriff. And of course, I worked hand in hand with him because he was a great person to work for and easy for me to work for. So, but whenever any instructions came along, I was always ready to go. Like Major Punky, he was just a wonderful person to meet. And of course, he has charge of the lottery now, and he was a major. And I could go to Major Punky anytime to seek information that I might need in my work, and also take advantage of all the classes along with the troopers, you know. That's where I got a lot of the training.
University.
But a University of Maryland, they had monthly classes. I attended the university, I have the whole wall of the certificates of attendance, the University of Maryland, FBI training schools. Maryland, Maryland State Police. I was always going for some kind of training to improve myself in the area of policing. In 1964, I was elected president of the Maryland Chiefs of Police Association, and in 1962, we met, 10 of us, in the Senate office building, in the Senate building, really, in Annapolis, and formed the Chief
of the Maryland Chiefs of Police Association, and helped to really get it started going. But now we have almost all of the chiefs of police in the state of Maryland belong to the, plus security police too, belong to the this organization. In fact, I'm a life member. We just had an executive meeting this past week down near Annapolis, and I always attend the meetings because it's you keep in contact with those people that you've known so long, you know, and you just don't want to get out of the mainstream of not knowing what's going on, you know.
Mrs. McMahon, when you became a teacher, what type of things did you have to know for teaching the biology?
Well, naturally you had to know biology, but what you learn in college, if you have a good teacher to teach you how to teach, you get the subject matter yourself. And I did have a very good teacher. In fact, she was from Harford County. I didn't know Bel Air at the time. Miss Sarah Smith of Jarrettsville, who taught how to teach subjects. But my education did not stop when I came to Bel Air in 1930. We were required once every 3 years to have a summer session at some college, and as a result, I attended one at University of Maryland. I went to Johns Hopkins Day School one time. I went to Johns Hopkins Night School, which I think goes by another name. And I went back to Western Maryland for a summer session. We had to do that to renew our certificates. We were not required to have a master's degree, which today I think they do have to have within 10 years. But we didn't have to do that. We took the course and had the credits, but we didn't have them added on to ours. I guess I could have had a master's if I had done that. But actually, when you start teaching, you've got to learn a lot yourself, and you've got to know a lot yourself. And I guess one of the big things, if they ask you a question and you don't know it, you say, "I don't know it, but I'll look it up and find the answer for you." So maybe that's how I learned.
Well, after your 3-4 years of teaching, what changes have you seen, such as in the materials, the criteria that the course demands, and the students and their attitudes?
Well, naturally, there have been changes all along the way in many of the sciences, on to the space science that we have today. But with me teaching biology, it was living things, and a living thing is a living thing. You don't change the human body or the animals. And if you once learned that plant and how it made its own food, and the animal, how it's got its food onto the human body, you just about knew your biology. You just had to learn different ways of teaching it. My classes became smaller, which were quite an advantage. I worked with a doctor who was at the research department of University Hospital, and he helped me a great deal with studies on the human body, giving me such things as a human heart, a human kidney, and things of that kind that the children could really see themselves as they were. And I can remember one boy that I taught, who's still the manager of the Benson Meat Market. If he found anything very special when he butchered a cow or a hog for market, he would call me. And I sometimes had an entire respiratory system of a cow and a hog to compare the two. So I got a lot of information from the real thing. That was always very interesting, and the children liked that. And then the Board of Education, of course, got stronger and gave us a little more money to spend. And as a result, I got models of those things. And I had a model of the human body where the children themselves could take the brain apart and see each part there. You can never see a mind or seeing or hearing, but you can see the part that's used for that. And they could take the entire human body apart. And the models that we had of both plants and animals was quite an advantage to them. I never taught by a textbook alone. They had plenty of textbooks that they could use, but I taught more by the living thing as it was.
Or do you remember any of the laboratory equipment that you used then?
Yes, when we moved to the new school from Gordon Street, we came down to the new school on Kenmore Avenue. I think I had 5 large microscopes. And having a class of 40 to 50 people, you see, they had to work together very much, because it was not until we were at the new school that I got another biology teacher in 1957. And when I left school, we had enough microscopes that every child in my class could use a microscope. He could prepare his own slide. He could prick his finger and see his own blood. He made his own things, and everyone had a microscope. And that was a great change. And I always had a laboratory and a classroom, and that made it good, because I could go down and set up a laboratory and have everything all ready for all experiments that we might go through. I guess as I meet children today who are grown, they remember more than anything, "Oh, I remember that frog I cut open," because a frog and the hog is very much like the structure of a human body, where of course a chicken is not. And we did have a frog for everybody in the high school, in the new high school, and everybody had a chance to dissect that frog. And they learned very much, evidently, because they bring up about opening that frog and what they saw. So it improved a great deal as we went along, and I can't think of anything. The last part of Dr. Willis's term as superintendent and Dr. Roberti starting, I can't think of anything that I really needed that I didn't get. They would provide us with any materials that would help us in teaching. And that was always very good, especially in a science, when you had to see a thing to know what you were doing.
Or how about, can you tell us about what some of the superintendents were like when you first came out, Mr. Milton Wright?
Mr. Milton Wright was a genuine person. The first day I saw him, of course, I got off the bus and met Dr. Earl T. Hawkins, who was to be my first principal, and he was about 6'4" or 6'5", and I was 4'11", and I felt that I was only a little girl to him. And so Mr. Wright said to me, "Your height hasn't grown very much." But I said, "No, but that won't make any difference in my teaching." And Mr. Wright was a very, very cooperative person and a genuine gentleman. Dr. Willis happened to be in the same class that I was in at Western Maryland College. So we knew each other before he became the superintendent here. He did not come to this county to teach on his first assignment. He came as a superintendent. And I can't recall exactly the year he came. But we had had several principals in between. And after Dr. Willis was Dr. Roberti. I only had three superintendents. I had more principals than that. But the two most outstanding principals that one could ever have was Dr. Earl T. Hawkins as my first one, and Dr. Willard Hawkins, who came from Union Bridge. And we used to feel that they could actually see through the wall and know what we were doing. And they kept right on their toes, and they knew what we were doing. But always did I feel they were cooperative.
Or Mr. McMahon, can you maybe describe some of the changes you've seen over your years as a policeman, such as in the new technology and as well as the types of crime that are being committed as compared to when you first were on the force?
Well, I suppose that I was the more fortunate one and that I started very early in 37 and worked so many years for the town of Bel Air. During my tenure with the town of Bel Air, I had no murders to solve. We did have a few fatal auto accidents. I can recall of about three. I remember one man who hung himself from a tree on Broadway. But it was just the usual things that back then, of course, as we mentioned training a bit ago. Of course, our men, of course, were equipped with the regular firearms. We had to have some firearms training, which you don't want to hand a gun to a man that doesn't know how to use it. So we were very cautious and very particular as to how the men used their firearms. And I don't recall that we ever had any officer use his gun in any way only to protect himself, maybe to show it, but not to actually use it against anyone. And of course, today, of course, they have the 9/11, you know, alarms, you know, that is really up to date. We didn't have that. I recall the first radio system that was in our county, and that was the sheriff's department. And of course, that was done through Sheriff Stevens at that time, with the cooperation and with the chief of police. And of course, I manned that radio system a great deal of the time, it was a very crude set. Dumont, I think, was the name of it. And we had our system, the town, we had only one car. In 1937, when I started with the town didn't have a police car. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Earl Birkins, who was later after Mr. Kunkel, the mayor, he bought a surplus car from the army, some branch of the service, an old Plymouth, and we had that we used for a while. And then, of course, as time went on, we increased in the number of police because the population was increasing. Traffic was getting a little more brisk because on the Saturday evenings back in the 40s, people would vie for a parking place on Main Street because Main Street was the main shopping area really for the county, and everybody came to visit and shop, I had to employ part-time officers to direct traffic, and they would never get off the corners until midnight. They had to work right up to midnight, and it was only 4 blocks of Main Street, but it was around and around and around that the traffic would move. But as time went on, while we got slides that we could show the men on how to do certain detective work and instructing them in firearms training, and then we got the photos that we had to take photos, and we of course were getting our separate ones. But I was still doing a lot of it at the sheriff's office then. But it was just a gradual thing that as the new equipment came along, budgets were a thing that the commissioners were very tight on. And of course, we had to prove to them or convince them that we needed this certain equipment, you know, that was coming out. And they were very cooperative with us, but it was just a normal graduation of equipment as it was needed.
Do you remember any of how that new equipment might have affected your jobs, which maybe as the new firearms or the computers or the bulletproof vests?
Well, we never had a bulletproof vest. We never experienced anything that really we felt was necessary to have. Bel Air was a very quiet, law-abiding town. Of course, we had a lot of people who drank and were disorderly, and we'd had a lot of fights and things of that sort, but we never had to resort to bulletproof vests and things of that sort. But
well, I know, as I think back now, for the last 5 years or so, and of course I retired in 68, but at that time we had absolutely no trouble at all with children coming in with any kind of intoxicating drink. And when he speaks of someone on the street, he's mainly speaking of more adults, or at least 20 and over, where we didn't have that in school, and we didn't even hear of drugs during my time of teaching. I would say that I taught the best years of teaching because we did not have problems from the outside or temptations for our children to have. And another reason, I believe, is because we had such cooperative parents. And I can remember one time during my teaching career, 5-6 years or so, that we had some teachers who had been there from 20 to 30 years. We did not have a change of teachers very often. And the parents respected us, and they guided their children, and we just didn't have problems like they have today.
I can think of problem that was touch and go with us, with the children at Bel-Air High School. There seemed to be some friction between the blacks and the whites, and of course they were going to have it out one afternoon after school, and of course I heard about it, and I proceeded to go to the area, which was Kenmore Avenue at that time, and they were forming, the blacks and the whites, and of course that was back, you know, when there was a lot of friction between the blacks and the white. But fortunately I talked to those youngsters and I pleaded with them, and I said, you will not gain anything by fighting. And I asked the white boys to go one way and the coloreds to go the other, and boy, they did it for me, and I was just so happy that it turned out that way. And other things, of course, the youngsters, of course, back then loved to they had cars, and they liked the sound of them. They wanted to make them noisy, and they sold what they call a Smitty muffler back then, or a straight through muffler. You know, some of them would just go straight through, and of course they enjoyed very much going up and down the streets in Bel Air, making a lot of noise. And of course we as officers had to try to curtail that. The commissioners would say, look, you officers got to do something with these kids. And of course we didn't always make A's with the kids when we had to talk to them about their mufflers or give them tickets. But that was one of the things that the boys, the high school kids, a lot of them remember now, that we had to talk to them many numbers of time, well, constantly, about them. And of course they of course tabbed me, you know, as the chief, as Muffler Mac. But I didn't mind that, just so they didn't hurt themselves and get out of hand too much. Why? But I got along with them quite well.
Or maybe both of you could talk on this subject. During the late 50s, early 60s, What was the integration doing? What type of frictions came about that as in the classroom as well as outside of it?
Well, as you know, we had Wright Brown case here in town. Wright Brown was never really in the town of Bel Air, but he had an attorney who was, they had a change of venue, you know, from Cambridge. You know, Wright Brown was very instrumental down there in burning a lot of the buildings and in the colored area down in Cambridge. And of course, they finally arrested Wright Brown, and of course, Mr. Kunstler, he wanted a change of venue, which they came to Bel Air, and Mr. Kunstler was here any number of days in the court discussing this case with the chief of police from Cambridge, who was Bryce Kennerman at that time, and I believe our present chief of police, Tom Brummel, he worked for the fire marshal's office, and I think he spent quite a lot of time in Cambridge at that time because of all the trouble they had down there. But we got along with the state police. They set up an outpost at the armory just in case there might be other people to come in, you know, and create trouble. Only one afternoon did we have a group of youngsters, which was recruited by a man by the name of Clarence Davis from Havity Grass, that came to Bel Air, and they marched around in a circle in front of the courthouse and chanted. Of course, I had instructed my officers. I said, "Now, we don't want to display a lot of force, but I'm going to be out here, but I want you to be behind the curtain." And so was the state police. They were ready any time that I needed to call upon them should there be any kind of difficulty or trouble. But these youngsters, I allowed them to do their thing, and they sang, and Clarence Davis, of course, made his speech, which was rather vulgar and nasty, but we tolerated it, and they soon saw that we were here and that we could take care of any situation, and they finally just dispersed and moved on away. And that case of Wright Brown was probably one of the more interesting cases that we had in the town of Bel Air back in the 60s.
How about your experience?
I was still teaching when we integrated schools, and I feel that Dr. Willis did a great deal in removing the colored children from the little old school on Hayes Street, and he built a high school that was equivalent or better than ours, and by doing so, the white children felt they could go to that school as well as to ours. And when we integrated, we just all went together, and there were black and white there and black and white in ours. And I taught them the same way. Maybe it was a little more difficult for them to get everything right in the beginning because they hadn't always had the greatest background and fundamentals of the thing. But I never minded one of them being in my class, and I don't think any one of them minded. And in fact, I've watched a few of them go to the very top, because right now I have doctors, ministers, ever so many people that I've taught, and some of them have been the colored ones. So I felt that we went together very, very well. Perhaps thanks to our superintendent and our principal, and of course we teachers cooperated with him.
I failed to mention one thing in the talking to about the Rap Brown case. One night, a car came to Bel Air with two black men in the car, and the information that we got was that it circled the courthouse. In all probabilities of putting off a bomb, they didn't succeed, or they felt that security was so tight that they better not try it, and they went back as far. At that time, there was a stone house which was called the Toll House, right at the Harford County Mall. And at that intersection, this car blew up, killing these two men and disintegrating a car. It just blew it to pieces, and the men too. One man's name was Weatherspoon, and I just don't recall the other man. But that's the only incident really that we had out of the Rap Brown case.
Or for, I guess this would be for both of you, but over the years, what changes have you seen the town go through? Like the new architecture, the real estate developments, and different things like that?
That's been terrific. Many of our old houses and old buildings were torn down, and we had to go around Jack Robinson's corner to get where we were going. We couldn't get from our house straight to the Balmer Road as we usually did, and that was because they were building this and that. And the whole town has changed in its numerous new buildings and large buildings, as the state building and the courthouse and the county building. I've seen all that happen since 1930, you see, which was tremendous, a change that's been made. And the old houses that we had here are gone. All the inns that he mentioned and so on, they were just memories for us.
Of course, the business area, which was within the three or four blocks, has moved out now to the mall area, the shopping centers. There is only one person on Main Street that was in business back there, and that was Hirsch Clothing Store, and that's business has been there for years, and of course I don't think he'll ever move out, but that is really the only business that's, and Mr. Snyder, of course, closed his store back last year, and that was the National Store, and they were the only two stores, so everything just moved out, and office space began to spring up all over town. Buildings, three-story buildings, and that has, it's just changed from a business really to legal business, lawyers and people like that. But it has just changed tremendously in the last 10 years, really. 10 years, we've seen the greatest change, because
Bel Air was always such a calm little town, a gentle town, a family town, where everyone got along with everyone.
Talking about the changes that you've seen in.
Yes, I was talking about this being such a get along town. Everyone got along with everyone else. And as I started to say, I heard my son say yesterday, we went to church in the morning, and neighbors visited neighbors, and friends visited friends, and relatives visited relatives. And he recalled this one family who came to our house to see television, I believe, and we always had Sunday night dinner together, or supper. And we all just were one big family. And now, I go to church and I don't know many, many, many of the people there. Mm-hmm. It's just entirely changed. You do not know the people who are in Bel Air.
Well, we started out going to the ME Church. Wasn't that the Methodist?
The Grace Methodist Thompson,
yeah,
M.D.
Methodist, in Bel Air. Now, of course, that's been torn.
That's been, united with the Methodist.
That's been torn. That church has been
Episcopal.
Torn down. Then, of course, we were the church on Main Street. That's opposite the Armory, you know. Don't blow the movies. We were there for years and years. And, of course, in what was the year?
1968.
They
had built this
church.
New church down here. And, of course, it was getting larger and larger and larger all the time. And this year they put on an extra part to the church, costing about $600,000, I believe they had in the last issue. And naturally that brings in more people. Besides of having a large sanctuary before, you just absolutely don't know the people anymore. They, I don't know where they've all come from, but...
When we first came to Bel Air, I think the population of Harford County was about 35,000. But now it's over 170,000, or in that area. That of course accounts for all the building and the necessity of changing the streets and the roads and one-way streets and things of that sort, you know, that had to be done in order to facilitate the flow of traffic, you know, keep things moving in an orderly fashion.
Or just one quick question. The church you were referring to, which one, what was its name?
The very first one we went to was Grace Methodist Protestant Church. It united all the Methodist church went together, the Methodist Episcopal, the Methodist Episcopal South, and the Methodist Protestant. And we're now called the Methodist United Church.
Oh, okay.
And so that is what this large building is,
yes.
The Bel Air United Methodist Church, United Methodist.
Of course, St. Margaret, they have built...
They have added on to theirs. Now, the Presbyterians, I believe, did a very good thing. Theirs got larger, too. But they built another church. And therefore, they have a smaller church to attend. And you know the people better in a smaller church.
Mm-hmm.
And they have two Presbyterians. They come together for meetings and concerts and their music and all the rest, but they still have their own church to worship in. And that was a good thing where they have two. We have two Lutheran churches here. And the smaller you keep a church in a town like this, the better it is.
Or Mr. McMahon, while you're on the force as the police chief, can you tell us about some of the mayor or I'm not mayors, I'm county councilman and the commissioner, what they were like?
Yes. You know, as I said, I was a camera bug. And I started taking pictures years ago. I am in the process right now of putting in the town office, the town hall, a picture, an 8x10 picture of the mayors, the chairman, as they were called back then, all the way back to about 1924. And the mayor that I have a picture of was Dr. Purnell Sappington. Dr. Sappington was a local doctor. He was, was the only doctor back then besides Dr. Hopkins. He was one of the doctors, but he was the chairman of the board back then. And then came after him, before him was Mr. Heiser. Mr. Frank L. Heiser was that's the earliest one that I have. That's 1924. Then Dr. Sappington. Then, of course, Mr. Kunkel, John N. Kunkel. Now, that's the Kunkel service people, you know.
And then I have a council.
Huh?
You didn't have council. You had five commissioners.
Well, there were five commissioners at that time, and they were chairmen of the board. Now, as I said before, we had no town hall. They just rented a room in one of the office buildings, and the one that I started in was the one down by the Johnson Credit Company on Office Street. Mm-hmm. But anyway, Dr. Sappington, John Kunkel, Mayor Birkins, Harry Osborne, and right on down the line. And I have all of them up to the present day. And we are in the process now with the town administrator fixing a place on the wall to install these people. Those people back then were just good, down-to-earth, sound business people, and of course, they took care of the town's problems. The town, as I recall, has had a water company. And of course, back in the 30s, I remember that they started putting a sewer system in. And from then, they just gradually and doing street work, but they were all wonderful people. Earl Birkins, of course, he was the captain of the Maryland State Guard. He had charge of the armory. Mr. Harry Osborne was a builder. He built the house. In fact, I think that we lived on Main Street. Mm.
The idea that all our people were local people made a lot of difference. They were interested in Bel Air.
They had to be people who lived in the town of Bel Air.
That isn't true the last couple of years, and that has made a lot of difference. They haven't known Bel Air and their kind of people.
But I hope to have those installed within the next week or so. I knew all these people. They were nice people. I did not serve under Mr. Heiser or Dr. Sappington, but I did all the other people up until 1973. O'Neill was the last chairman that I served under.
Or is there any other experiences or things you might like to add about your schooling or your time on the police force, such as?
Well, I of course retired in 1973. I've enjoyed retirement immensely. Would not like to go through it again, but I had a wonderful experience. I loved the people that I worked for. I loved the people in the town, and of course, me being almost 75 years old, the people, you know, that I knew back then, a lot of them are gone. And it's the younger people that, and being out of the mainstream since 1973, I don't mix with the people as much as I used to. Of course, I play a little golf every so often, maybe a couple of times a week. But I still go to the police department. I try to know them. They honor me each year by letting me ride with the chief and greet the people up and down the street, and I thoroughly enjoy that. And I just look back at my years at living in town when I first rode in on the McMahon bus and I saw the Vaughn McMahon Hotel. That was the place for me. I was already established, so I've loved it. And I hope I can live a few more years to enjoy everything that Bel Air has to offer.
How about you, Mrs. Mayor?
Well, my wife and I lived on Main Street, of course, for 20 years.
I think one of the interesting things in our life during the 30s, 40s, and 50s was that for some reason or another, I was frequently called the welfare teacher. And in so doing, it seemed all the people of our school, the high school and the elementary, and I worked with Mr. Tom Hackett a great deal from Churchville, and we would take food, clothing, or anything that was needed. And my husband and I would go out any time of the day and night that we were available and take materials to families who needed it. And we were learned over the county as being such people that we could be called on to bring them food and so on. And you know, we never had to want for anything. There were always people in the town of Bel Air who might call me and say, I understand you're helping a family where there are five children and no father. And I said, yes, we are. She said, I'd like to send you a check tomorrow. So it was not unusual for us to get money that way and buy food for them. And we would go to families when they were in need. There was a family who had a car accident, as about five of them from that family got off of a bus. And we went to help them, and the mother had to go to the hospital with some, and we stayed there and got dinner for the others and so on. So I think one of the great things we did was to furnish supplies for those who were in need and in trouble.
Well, my experience, even from the beginning, was a never-ending thing of helping and assisting someone. There would be always people who would be destitute coming through town. I don't have any money. I need gas. Can you furnish me some gas? Sure, we'll give you gas. I've been tossed out of a woman that I've been tossed out of a car. I live in York, Pennsylvania. I don't have any money. I have no way of getting to York. Could you buy me a ticket to York, Pennsylvania? Yes, sure. There were so much of that kind of thing, you know, with me as a police officer, as well as assisting her with her welfare department in the school and around the county.
And we never seemed to lose by doing it. As he mentioned about the people that he would loan a dollar or loan something to, it was maybe unusual to us one day to get a letter, and it'd be from someone he didn't even know and say, here's a dollar I owe you, or something like that. We never seem to lose by doing good to other people.
This is just a minor question that seems like, but in life in the 80s now, do you ever, when people come up to you or would you ever suspect them as being sort of maybe crooked? Did you ever have any suspicions like that when you were doing this charity type of work?
Oh, no, never when we were doing that kind of work at all. No, I would say there might be something now, but of course we are older and we're not doing that kind of thing now. But we would go to homes where we would be received with open arms. We never felt, I can't remember ever feeling afraid or not wanting to go to a home. We were always received and with good wishes from them and with open arms, as I say. Don't you feel that's
well,
the way
I,
we
I
were?
I can remember a few times that people would ask for help, and you'd give them either money or gasoline for their car. You'd never hear anything more from them. But that was just once in a great while. People that are destitute, you know, and need real help like that are people who remember, you know, to pay it back. So there was a lot of it, but and some, of course, you didn't get back, but most you did. But it was always rewarding that you could do things for people, you know.
In the 1950s, we came across a little girl who really needed help. She was only in the 8th and 9th grade of school. We gave her the opportunity of coming to live with us if she wanted to. But we told her she could not decide before at least a week. Her father was not living. Her mother did not have much to live on and had three boys in the family. And we took that little girl. We sent her through school. We bought her clothes. She lived with us. We sent her to college. We gave her her wedding. She now feels as if she's a real daughter of ours. Our son feels that she is his sister. And she never comes to town to stay overnight, that this isn't home to her. We did not legally adopt her, but we have always felt she's been an adopted daughter.
Unofficially adopted daughter. She's a lovely girl, and we are very proud.
And she has two children who are also finished college, and they are just wonderful to us. And she never neglects to call and see how we are. And she's now living in New Jersey. Her husband worked for the government. They've gotten along just beautifully with a new home and several cars, and everything just worked good for them, of which they give us a lot of credit, but they had to want it in order to do it. And that was one of the highlights of our life.
Just one thing, going back to yours when you were a teacher, what were the different extracurricular activities that they have then?
I can remember the most outstanding one, I would say, were the clubs we had. We might have a photography club. We would have a welfare club. We would have an usher club. We would have clubs that teachers would sponsor. And then we were given a certain period, one time a week, when we could meet with those people who signed up for our club. Now that was their real extracurricular thing. Of course, they always had extracurricular sports. Their physical education teachers took care of that. We never did get extra pay for any of those things, which they do today. I remember for about 8 to 10 years that I was so-called the nurse in the school, maybe because I was a biology teacher, but there was a little room beside my classroom, and anyone that was sick or hurt came to that little room and I took care of them. And that was before we had a school nurse. We did not really have a school nurse until we came to the new school in 1948.
Let me see. I had another question. Mr. McMahon, you were talking about that you enjoyed photography very much. What got you started into that field?
Well, very, very early, I bought a camera, one of those old-time folding cameras, and it was a 616, and I bought it at Richardson's drugstore because I just felt the need of taking some pictures that I thought would be valuable in the future. And I bought this camera for $20, and I started taking pictures. Of course, I had already been taking pictures for the sheriff's department, which they had a camera, and I had to set it up and make the slides, you know, for it. But I've just always enjoyed taking pictures.
You might mention you were called on for pictures in the Bel Air book.
In the what?
In the book that the lady edited.
Oh yes, I contributed the Ledoux book, you know, picture of the buildings of Bel Air. I contributed a lot of pictures.
At least half in that book.
And of course, they out of the blue sky, they named me archivist one time. The town of Bel Air did, but they never asked me if I would like to be that, and I didn't know very much about it. All I did was for my own personal thing, you know. Of course, I've never been selfish with it. I've always liked to share it with anybody that would like to have pictures of mine. And but I have a lot of pictures, and I just enjoy taking them. I take a lot of pictures. I take pictures of everything. I like to show them to you later.
Well, that would be very nice. Or in just summarizing, are there any other experiences or changes that you'd like to tell us about? Either one?
Well, I don't know. I feel like I'm a very fortunate person. I'm fortunate in the fact that I met my wife, who has been a wonderful companion to me all these years, and I'm fortunate, I think, that I arrived in Bel Air at about the right time. And I have enjoyed living in Bel Air. We have raised our family here in Bel Air. We have made lots and lots of friends. Some of them have departed from us, but Bel Air has just been a great place for me, and I've been so happy to be here and with my family, and I hope that I can live a few more years and enjoy the town as most everybody else does. It's a great place to live. It's a great place to visit and a better place to live.
We've been married 54 years, and I've been here 56, 2 years before we were married. But the 54 years have been very memorable ones.
Okay, that was...